Hey everyone, we're going to get started. Thank you all so much for being here. I'm so thrilled that there are so many masochists at FDJ. My name is Zoya Tierce. I'm a reporter for Grist, where I cover climate change and health. And I pitched this panel to SCJ, and I just said that I wanted to make their attendees just feel really itchy for about an hour and a half, and they were like, sure, why not? So I'm going to do a really quick sort of like leveling of the playing field here, just so folks understand what exactly I'm talking about when I talk about climate change and health and that overlap. So climate change impacts, and can everyone see all right? Yep, all right. Climate change impacts health in a number of ways. I'm just going to be talking about this, but we will be talking about many of these other ways that climate change impacts health over the course of this panel. This is a rendition of various diseases that are going to be rising as climate change continues to influence the U.S. This is for a piece I wrote about five illnesses that are projected to rise. And so you've got things like Powassan virus, which is a tick-borne illness carried by the black-legged tick, which also carries Lyme. Vibrio, which is a really terrifying disease that's carried by shellfish. It's a bacteria. You have this thing, which is a crazy bug that carries an illness called Chagas, which is actually, you get it when this bug actually defecates on your mouth while you're sleeping. Horrible, horrible. Thank you all for coming. this is Valley Fever, which, speaking of the West, is a real issue here. Not in this state, but sort of in this part of the world. And is predicted to rise. It's a fungal-borne illness that lives in the soil. And then you have a chikungunya, which is a mosquito-borne illness. But this is just to say that things are changing, and they're changing pretty rapidly, and we're trying to keep an eye on what's going on. And this field in general is sort of growing, so researchers are sort of expanding their knowledge of what's happening at a breakneck pace right now. So how does climate change lead to disease? So to me, it falls into four buckets. You've got carriers on the move. That's a really good example here. This is a piece that the New York Times did about dengue. It's carried by mosquitoes. So you can see by sort of the end of the century, you're looking at a way larger range for mosquitoes. Right now, there are some cases of dengue in Texas, but apart from that, you're not looking at this kind of widespread dengue fever issue. So warming temperatures can help this illness carried by mosquitoes move up through the U.S. and become more intense in other parts of the world. You also have this boom and bust cycle of extreme weather. And that really happens when you've got sort of extreme drought or extreme rainfall followed by the opposite extreme. So I think like fungal pathogens love this. Anyone who's been mushroom foraging knows that after a big rain, you've got a lot of fruiting bodies out there in the woods. Now, when you're a fungal spore that lives in the soil and you really tend to grow and explode during this boom cycle of wetness, when it gets very dry, you can disseminate more easily in the air and fall into people's lungs and that kind of thing. And then you have this sort of more complicated element of animals meeting up in new configurations. I spoke to a researcher who told me that climate change is sort of shaking the world like a snow globe and causing these animals to sort of meet up in new configurations and share disease that way. And that's how things like spillover happen, when a disease moves from animals to humans. And that's really terrifying to researchers. People I speak to are really worried about that. And then there's this fourth bucket, which is, no one really knows what the hell is going on. They have some ideas, though, and that's what we're going to talk about right now. So I don't know, who here knows about Candida auris? Anyone? Okay, nice. This is a fungal-borne pathogen that is growing in popularity. It's growing. It shouldn't be popular. It's very scary and very dangerous. So there's various theories about why this illness has been more prevalent among humans lately. Because by and large, fungal pathogens, there are tons of them out there in the world, but we get very few of them. Humans are largely, in many ways, immune to some fungal pathogens because we run so hot. Fungus does not like to live in our bodies. Now, in 2009, that started to change. You saw cases of this illness going up, and everyone was really confused about why. I talked to a researcher named Arturo Casaval, who's sort of like the leading mycologist in the U.S., and he had a theory. You have to go back a couple years to tell you about the theory. So about 65 million years ago, you have an asteroid that hits the planet, dinosaurs are wiped out. And this is how the theory goes. After this happened, you had the rise of a fungal planet. Fungi took over the planet. This is not a photograph. They didn't have cameras at the time. But you had this world that was sort of dominated by fungi. And so as you can see in the photograph, there are probably tons of fungal pathogens rolling around. After this, you have the rise of the mammalian era. Now, that's important to note because that means that, you know, there were small reptiles and small mammals after the dinosaurs were wiped out. But the reptiles didn't do so well. The mammals did much better. The theory goes that reptiles, which run cooler, obviously, were more susceptible to these fungal illnesses. And mammals were not. Were able to thrive and move on and sort of inherit the earth. So that's why this is so concerning, right? Because mammals are, our human threshold should not allow for something like Canada auris to proliferate. And yet it is. So in 2009 in Japan, doctors clocked the first cases of this. And then soon after, this illness exploded sort of simultaneously on three continents. And that was really concerning. This researcher I spoke to said that is the greatest evidence to him that this is caused by climate change, that perhaps this fungal pathogen, which has not been able to access the human body, had evolved to adapt to a warmer planet. And by that, in that vein, had managed to sort of infiltrate the human body. So does that make sense to folks? Is this kind of a hard idea? So yeah, climate change has forced this fungi to adapt, and that means that we're more susceptible. So this is an example of how extreme this has gotten. This is the cases in the U.S. about it a decade ago. This is now. And so the takeaway is that not all these stories have to be like this. I don't think that we need to scare readers all the time, and I frankly don't want to be scared all the time either. There are plenty of solution stories in this realm. I wrote this piece about this initiative in Montana, profiling this woman named Sita Collinglass, who's here today. And she basically brought out a team of canine workers to help her track down disease on her reservation. She was tracking down a disease called, or she plans to track down this disease called chronic wasting disease, which is a prion disease, which is very terrifying as well. But the good news is that people are working together. I have often found when I work on these kinds of stories that communities really band together to help each other out and to protect each other. And that, to me, feels like a really great thing and a really great source of hope. And then you have things happening at like Harvard, for example, where they're teaching doctors how to prepare for climate change and treat climate-related illnesses. And in general, I feel as though there are just too many stories and too little coverage about this. There's tons of stories here, some that Benji has written, and then others, that climate change threatens to undo 50 years of public health gains. That's a massive story. I think more people should be writing about it. So, and here are our speakers. I'm not going to introduce them. They're going to talk about themselves a little bit as I ask them questions, but we're going to launch right in. So I just gave sort of my rendition of what climate change and health means to me. I want to ask each of you sort of, what does that overlap mean to you? And maybe we'll start with Dr. Blue.
So climate change and health, one of the things that I usually go with is a little broader, even beyond climate change, and just say, planetary health. And planetary health has a lot of wide-ranging aspects, and the infectious diseases is only part of it. We talked about rising temperatures, the extremes of weather, but with that, you also have migration of human populations from areas that are impacted by that to other areas. You actually have some, as we all know, increasing wealth inequality. And then you have demand for increased protein sources that are out there. And then they turn to people who have a lower income to provide them. So we have protein sources going to high-income areas. And then you see live animal markets. You have urban livestock. You have poor livestock keepers who start to get into that overlap zone of animals and people and the option for spillover. So as Andrea mentioned, the climate drivers and the planetary health issues can really have wide-ranging effects on the diseases that thrive in warmer temperatures, like the Vibrio that you mentioned, the Naegleria, the amoebic encephalitis that you can see, but then the vectors. And so the vector-borne diseases and the migration of people with those diseases into the realm of the vectors. These are tropical diseases that are moving north. And then you have individuals who are used to those tropical diseases now into the temperate climate where we have the more epidemic disease. So that's all symptom of transmission. So that's kind of what I see, you know, which didn't mention resistant bacteria, which is also why Canada forest is finding a niche because of the resistance that it has naturally in our use of antimicrobial, antifungal in health and hospitals and healthcare environment. So you have the water, you have the diseases that can, you know, naturally, you have the vector-borne diseases, and then you have the spillover, the emerging infections, which our last pandemic is an example of. So those are several of the things that I'm looking at and what it means to me. I'm an infectious disease doctor. I work in epidemiology, healthcare epidemiology, in the
talking to McDonald's in English. In English, as close as possible. That's Sita calling. So. Sutaki Sakabokwin, Rain Woman, Last One Standing on the Battlefield, making the war cry. I could retain that name. And my explanation and what I think about climate health and climate change and planetary health word is, thank you. I can't hear you. Is this one picking up a little better? All right. Okay, so hello everybody. I think my definition for and my ideas that come about when I think about planetary health and climate change and human health is that a lot of people don't see the Earth as a living being right now. And the Earth is very much like a body, just like our body. We can stand to have little pieces of skin tissue taken out, biopsied, we can have limbs cut off, but when our internal systems and structures start to get degraded, that's when we have overall failure. And so that's kind of what I see right now, is that the Earth is really out of balance, and we're taking a bit too much tissue from certain places, and our blood is and so if you look at the Earth and our planet and our atmosphere like a body, then you see that we need to start viewing it. Right now, every system of study is siloed. Thank you. Every system that we learn about in school that we go to study is siloed. Nothing is intersectional, and so nothing will be fixed until we start changing the way we look at the world and our health.
Hey, I'm Benji. I'm an environmental reporter at Vox. Often I write about biodiversity loss, habitat loss, and I think for me, when I think about the intersection of climate change and health, I think about how often some of the issues that I write about feel distant to folks because they're not about, they don't seem to be about humans, but ultimately what I've learned through a lot of my reporting, and I think there's a movement to make this much clearer, there is that a lot of issues related to environmental harm are very much driving some of the health crises that we're seeing, whether it's ticks, mosquitoes, et cetera. And there are really interesting connections. I mean, we know that when you fragment a forest, for example, some of the species that are more likely to survive and do well there happen to be more likely to carry zoonotic parasites. So that's one of the, I think that we need to do a better job at intersecting these issues, and I would love to see more collaboration between environmental reporters and health reporters to bring these issues together.
Does this work better? Thanks. Okay. Suta, I want to ask you to explain chronic wasting disease and why that's an issue on your tribe, and what you're doing to sort of combat that issue. If you could talk about the dogs a little bit, but really just define chronic wasting disease, because I'm sure people don't really understand what that fully means, and it's terrifying.
I would refer to Dr. Blue. Chronic wasting disease is a prion. And so it's not a bacteria, it's not a virus, it's a prion. And it stays viable in soil and water for a minimum of 2 years. And it has the ability to be taken up by roots, stems, and leaves. And so this is a problem when you come from a community like mine where we're subsistence living, and I pick about 10 pounds of mint a year and drink it. And what's going to happen to me and what's going to happen to my community if chronic wasting disease is not the only thing that's being taken up by these plants. And so it's a prion that's affecting ungulate species, which are elk, moose, and deer. It's jumped pigs, mountain sheep, and a caribou. And once it gets into the herd, it's not killable in any way. There's no way to kill it. They can't burn it. They can't flood it out. They just don't know what to do with it. So it's like bovine spongy encephalitis, a BSE, mad cow disease, Alzheimer's, dementia. And so I'm concerned about it because it has jumped to pigs, and we, like now in the West, we're having an invasive wild boar population move in. And if those get to our pristine area right now in Glacier National Park, because we're kind of protected by the Rocky Mountains right now, but my tribal leaders have said we're on the verge of cultural collapse if we can't use any of our roots, medicines, leaves. We won't be able to have sweat lodges anymore, because all of the plants that I'm looking at are plants that I've stocked in wetland cells. So I'm a hydrologist by training, and I clean up island contamination. So all of the plants that I'm concerned about culturally are also plants that I use to stock wetland cells to take out heavy metals, because they're the most efficient plants in removing the metals. And so they clean up the water in the soil really well. So what happens when people start eating things? And with 2020 and the pandemic, everybody moved to wanting to have a garden and wanting to live off the land. And I don't think the state of the land is in condition to live off.
Dr. Blue, I wanted to ask you about your practice. I'm not sure, I think we talked on the phone about this before, but you're not really seeing climate patients, quote unquote, come into your practice yet. But you are bracing for the impacts of climate change on human health. And I'm wondering what you're sort of prepping for, what you're thinking about as you think about sort of a future that's sicker and more impacted by heat and other, and vector-borne diseases and other consequences of climate change.
Yeah, so it's hard to say that what I do day to day is exactly impacted by climate health, but then in another way it is. We're looking for Canada auris in our hospitals because of the concern of it for an infection prevention to get into the antibiotic resistance, can be kind of tied back in these thin threads, even to a warming planet. But there are some of those diseases that we mentioned, such as Negleria, the amoebic encephalitis, that I might see once in every 10 years, and now we're seeing it much more commonly. Not necessarily in this area as common as we're seeing it in the upper Midwest and along the eastern seaboard, but then that has to be in our differential diagnosis every time we see that. So we are impacted by these sort of things. We have tick-borne diseases in Idaho. We don't have Lyme's disease. We have Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We have ehrlichiosis. We have Colorado tick fever. So we're seeing those vector-borne diseases more commonly as well. So these sort of things will increase in frequency, but we're also impacted by travel. You all probably hopped on a plane and have been from other parts of the country So if you were to get sick, I don't only have to know what's going on in Boise, Idaho, but I have to know where you came from, what's going on in that area. We have the same thing all across the globe. We have somebody who can pop on from Africa in 24 hours of solid flying, can land in Boise, Idaho. So we are impacted by Ebola in Uganda. We're impacted by Marburg right now. For anybody who shows up with a viral-like syndrome who was recently within the incubation period of some of those hemorrhagic fevers. So we're increasingly having to prepare for those, and you know anything in healthcare is not cheap to do that. And so how much do we have to prepare for these diseases that we see infrequently because we might? So day to day, I'm not sure I can point to any patient I saw today in the hospital as like, yeah, that's from climate change. But then again, a lot of it probably is related, especially the things that Benji was mentioning in a much wider context. We do have those thin threads that connect them to changes in our planetary health. Now, as Sue mentioned, I use the example all the time as the planet as a person. You know, our lungs are in the Amazon rainforest. Our waters are along the seaboard where Vibrio lives. So we're seeing those things. The biodiversity is our microbiome. And we all hear about probiotics and how we fix the biodiversity that's within us. So as we lose the biodiversity in our ecosystems, we are going to set ourselves up for either jump for those diseases into the human population or larger mixes with resistant viruses and things like that.
Yeah, on the biodiversity front, I'm going to pass that down to Benji because I have a question about that. How do you see the, I mean, you had a panel on biodiversity. I don't know how many of you were there, but it was really fascinating. And how do these two crises overlap? I mean, how does biodiversity and health overlap? You've covered tick-borne illnesses, avian flu. I mean, how do you see that connection there?
Yeah, it overlaps a lot. And I think, as I mentioned, we're starting to see more people become aware of that. I think COVID really helped, and there's this new movement to draw awareness to preserving forests and restoring wetlands and so forth in order to prevent the next pandemic. That's a big concern right now. There was a bill introduced in the U.S. in 2020 called, I think, Preventing Future Pandemics, that is specifically targeting this, avoiding biodiversity loss for the benefit of pandemic prevention. So there's very much a clear connection that's happening more and more. But there are a lot of different ways to look at the intersection of these issues that we're talking about. I think ticks is a really good example. We know that climate change is causing the range expansion of a couple different species, including the black-legged tick or deer tick, which carries Lyme disease, babesiosis, anaplasma, and a bunch of other diseases. And that's spreading not only north, but also it looks like it's also spreading west. I'm from Iowa, and there's like so many ticks there, and it's something that I'm very much concerned about. And I live in New York, where it's also really bad. But another intersection, not just with climate change, but with the loss of something like predators. So what's a little bit counterintuitive is that when the Northeast was massively deforested like 100 years ago, and we have since brought back a lot of those forests. And one of the consequences of bringing back some of those forests is that more deer are now surviving there. But because there are not predators like bears and wolves in such abundances that there were in the past, these deer populations are now out of control, and deer allow tick populations to bloom. They're not reservoirs themselves for these parasites, but they allow the tick populations to grow, and that therefore makes people more exposed to ticks that carry these illnesses. So there are a lot of different ways that these issues are intersecting, but I do think the pandemic, for all of its awfulness, has helped bring this to light.
Yeah, that's really well said. I think that one thing that still hasn't been fully brought to light is the impact of climate change on tribes. I spent about a week with you in Montana, and one of the things that you told me that really stuck with me is you said that climate change is like a massive experiment on tribes, on indigenous people in the U.S., and that your health is literally on the line. Can you talk about that? Do you feel like you're being experimented on by climate change, and how does that manifest for you?
Yeah, well, I think we're being looked to, and I always say that Native people are are the canaries of climate change. And it's because we live so close to the land that we will know first, and we feel and experience it first. And so, but going back to the biodiversity part, that's one of my theories on why our wildlife are getting so sick, is because, well, for one, we're treating wildlife like farm animals. And it's not your fault, it's just the system, you know, that it needs to change, because wildlife, CWD especially, is known to come from these farmed animals, and elk farms and stuff like that, deer farms. And so whenever we take a wild animal and we take it out of its natural environment, bad things happen. And there's no pharmaceuticals that can help and completely keep that animal healthy. What that animal needs is a complete access to traditional lands and environments, because like us, it knows what plants to eat, it knows where to find them, and they doctor themselves. And so you'll see, that's how Native women learned how to have abortions, is by watching the deer. And the deer will tell you when there's going to be a really hard winter, and they'll start eating just tons and tons of this certain herb. And then it's a no-fail abortant, so they drop their fawns. And so Native women, my tribe specifically, knew when to not have children, because we knew it was going to be a hard winter because we watched the deer. And so if we're farming and putting all of these wild animals into like pet status or cow status, which is where disease also happens, you just get an explosion of disease, and there's nothing, it's just in the smart practice. But I kind of got off
the Well, yeah, no, I think that's spot on and well said. I think that my question was also sort of about the ways in which you feel as though, indigenous people in the U.S. are sort of on the front lines of climate change. And I think that you summed it up pretty well. Mm-hmm. I mean, are there any other ways in which you feel like your tribe is sort of, you said looked to, your tribe is looked to, so...
Indigenous nations, they should be looked to, because there's so many practices. Like, first we need to get past this idea that indigenous people aren't white people, and we're not smart enough to have sciences and all of this cool stuff. But we have sciences, and in our history, we know timelines that are not timelines we work on today, right? 10 years ago is a long time. 500 years for an indigenous person is not a long time. We can remember our grandparents' names. And so we remember all of their stories as well, too. And so when we start thinking about climate change and how to approach it and where the solutions are, they're with the people we try to exterminate. They're with the communities who have lived with the land for thousands of years and have learned to adapt with those as they change. And so my tribe, I want them to be looked to, and I want us to help guide the climate change. And I'm trying to get my rock climbs and my fasting structures. You'll see them if you're an alpine mountaineer in Glacier Park and climb to the top. You'll see rock stacks. Please don't do hippie rock stacks. Those are 10,000 plus years old. And if we put a tent over them and this little straw into them and take a sample, we'll have 11,000 years of climate data available to us. We can tell when we were camped there, what we were eating, what plants were growing. And there's no other nations right now on this continent that can say, I have 10,000 years of climate data. But I'm trying to get the attention to say, hey, my tribe is very knowledgeable. We have the data. It needs to be protected. So if anyone's friends with the superintendent for information.
Dr. Blue, I want to ask you about, I guess this is sort of a solutions-oriented question, about the ways that doctors can help each other. Something that's come up a lot in my reporting is that, you know, a doctor in the Northeast might be able to really easily identify Lyme, but someone in California has a hard time doing that. Something that I've thought about a lot in the course of my reporting has been, there's got to be a way for people to share this knowledge. It seems like that preparation element is super crucial. Are there initiatives underway that would do that? Or are you thinking about that as someone who thinks a lot about climate change and health? I mean, is there a way for doctors to sort of band together and help each other out as these effects become more severe?
So a couple of things with that. One is we do that, you know, pretty readily now with electronic databases for clinical trials and case reports, and the ability to, you know, share that even across social media and things like that. So, you know, I think the diagnosis of specific conditions is something we're pretty good at this stage. The thing that I see is we tend to get very siloed into the treatment, and we talk about it being healthcare, but it's really sick care, and we don't get out of front, in front of it. And so in general, when we're trying to prevent diseases, it has to, we have to take a much broader look at that. And you mentioned that we're starting to talk to climate-related health matters in medical school. And so I think the doctors who are coming up will have better understanding of it to bring it full circle back to the prevention. And so when you're doing that, it's not only what we can talk to in preventative health, but what we say when, you know, well, what can I do? You can look at what you eat, you know, our food choices, your travel, the microplastics in our clothes, the little things that have big impacts. Where is your wood coming from? Is it related to deforestation? You know, what are the practices of the food system that we're doing? We're taking local produce that should be local. We're moving it across the United States or across countries. And so we'll have outbreaks of diseases from raspberries that came up from Mexico. We have feral pigs in California that spread salmonella in the upper Midwest. We have, you know, so those sort of things, and that recognition that it's beyond the what that patient has into the prevention, I think, is the important part. And they don't pay you to do that. They pay us to take care of sick people. So, you know, we talked about income inequality, how our healthcare system is broken, and how we even allow diseases to flourish in underserved populations. So that's what I hope to see in the next generation of doctors and changes in the healthcare system.
Okay, let's open it up to any... Oh, did you want to say something?
It's just that for a lot of vector-borne diseases, there isn't the necessary surveillance. Aside from mosquitoes, there's a lot of surveillance for mosquitoes. Obviously, like, that is a major problem. In the U.S., ticks is a much bigger issue. I think 80% of vector-borne illnesses come from ticks. So this is a huge number. So I think that's just another thing that needs to be fixed, is just better surveillance.
Totally. That's come up constantly as well. We do not have a good system in place. I mean, even the U.S., which has tons of resources for this kind of stuff, is not thinking about surveillance in the right way, which is a real bummer for a lot of us.
I'm actually an EPA-funded study, and my project manager told me if CWD isn't controllable, why look into it?
Yeah, so
how do we manage things if we don't know things about them?
Right, yeah. Let's open up for questions. Anyone have any questions for any of our panelists? I can direct, or you can, and please just, there are actually some really strict rules about this. Members of SEJ first, although I think that really everyone's fine. And then just state your name and affiliation when you're asking a question, and no speeches. And then maybe just if you can project as loud as you can.
It's a group of plants. They're usually wetland aquatic plants, which are a mixture of willows, cattails, mints, and other like
Hi, my name is Will. I'm with Wyoming Public Radio, and I wanted to ask about how we manage wildlife in the West. For instance, in Western Wyoming, we feed our elk and deer to keep them away from roadways and ranches and things like that. A lot of folks have said that is a good way to basically cause the spread of CWD even faster. Do you think that we should be doing that, Suta, and also Dr. Blue, and you know whoever wants to answer this? And how do we continue to take this whole presentation in mind as we manage wildlife in this region?
Right. Feeding wildlife is one of those ways where we thought we were going to do good, but then it's really bad. I think the state's officials need to look at migration routes and create some bridges there. That's the most effective way to let animals cross the road and to not inhibit their migration and to allow them access to their traditional foods.
Hi, I'm Anna Gibbs. I'm a freelance journalist. Thanks for talking to us about this important issue. I was wondering about, I've been reporting a little bit on avian flu and trying to figure out how to communicate risk when it seems like it's sort of random a little bit based on like how much exposure there is to birds, that like it just could happen that there's a mutation and it does spread over to humans. How do we talk about like pandemic risk when it's sort of hard to know how big that risk is, I guess, if it comes down to the numbers?
Okay. So sure, the first, you know, get back to the elk, and exactly right. When you start to get animals out of their normal patterns, and especially you get them congregating in numbers that they're not used to, that's when you can have other epidemic diseases, not only the potential for wasting disease in the herd, but I've also had zoonoses from pasturella from elk, and that can be spread in those settings. So there are a lot of things, and it's just getting out of their natural feeding cycle, congregating where they shouldn't. So I definitely agree that is a setup for potential issues. And when it'll occur kind of gets to the question of the avian influenza as well, and we'll let Benji talk about this also. But this gets into, so influenza is also an RNA virus similar to coronavirus, which RNA viruses are more likely to have mutations in the replication. Influenza is also unique in that it has a segmented genome. So if you have an infection with more than one influenza in a similar animal, like you have in wet markets, you can just pick up one of that segmented genome from a totally different influenza virus, and then you have this Frankenstein that comes out of it. What you're talking about in avian influenza, since the avian host does not necessarily have nasal mucosa like we do, it is designed to attack a different cell line. So it doesn't go with the sniffles that our common influenza does. But it may well be just one mutation away to get it closer to that. And then that drift that happens instead of the major shifts can get it into a much more transmissible person to person. So when we talk about that risk, we know that pandemic will happen. But how do you say, is it in the next month? Is it next 6 months? So we get that urban livestock. We get everybody has chickens now. We have the geese in Boise that are here to stay year round. So we are starting to see that disruption, like the elk, that of these natural migration routes. We have the domestic animals, and we have people who may be much more closer to their chickens than they should be. We can see some of those pandemics occur.
Yeah, I mean, just adding to what you said, I think from the scientists that I've talked to, the thinking through risk is a lot about, like, what raises the alarm for people that I've spoken to is just when you see avian influenza, like H5N1, the strain that's circulating right now, starting to circulate within populations of, like, so-called mixing vessels, so pigs, or there's an outbreak in a mink farm last September, and that really raised the alarm because it's an influenza virus, it can go through reassortment and basically pick up parts of the DNA of another virus and become this Franken virus
And so that's the real concern. So when you start to see these outbreaks in populations of animals that are not necessarily birds, but animals that can carry both human viruses and avian viruses, that's when it starts to get concerning, especially if it's given a lot of time to circulate in that population. And we actually saw in September that scientists think that there was some adaptation that the virus picked up to be better able to attack mammals. So that's very much concerning. And then the only other thing I'll say about the avian flu is that when we think about risk, we should also think about risk when it comes to the price of food. So we know that what's happened right now, we've killed 60 million poultry in the U.S. alone, and that has raised the cost of poultry and eggs. And for people who are already struggling to buy food during inflation, this is adding to that problem. So we should think about risk in multiple dimensions.
So from a water perspective too, sampling water, there's drought as a climate factor there. And when we have drought, we have warmer water, less water, next time in a bacteria type stuff that causes those flu-like symptoms. I don't know if called cyanobacteria. The birds are landing in these places and they might not experience symptoms right away and then they're flying from the place they're dropping.
Hi there. My name is Sherry Geyer. I'm an independent journalist in Phoenix. My question kind of piggybacks on hers. I'm actually writing a story right now about risk, climate risk prediction models for the insurance industry. Do you have any risk models for, you know, the kind of risk we're talking about when it comes to foodborne illnesses and influenza and so forth?
Well, so nothing that I know of that really stands that out, because you're really talking the insurance industry has risk models that go beyond a lot of things we do in medicine. So certainly have forecasted the changes in the vector habitats, right? But what you can factor in is, as you know, we talked about the deer, but rodents are huge. Rodents and bats are one of those the two vector the two species that often intersect with a lot of these other vector-borne illnesses. And so, how do you predict those going in then? And you also need to predict how many people are then in the areas of risk because they're recreating or working or into that. So that is where it gets tough. So the short answer is I don't know any good risk prediction for things like the pandemic related to avian influenza, but I'm sure somebody, does. And just brought up something that I want to mention that hasn't been mentioned yet, is that when we look at this planetary health, whether it's climate change or all these other things we're looking at, right in the center of that is population. So population and the use of carbon into the climate change, population as it affects migration and human density. So the doubling time of our planetary population, we talk about planetary health, what are we able to sustain in that setting? And really, what are our thresholds going to be if we think, our carbon footprint per person now is high when we have that many more people, and how is that going to impact? That's totally off your topic, but that's also has to go into the risk of a pandemic when you're talking about population density. Does anybody else want to?
From a water perspective, NOAA and the USGS does forecasting on catastrophic floods. So that would be not building your home in a floodplain or a riparian area, and a lot of municipalities are really against how when you start getting people where they can't build their houses.
You want to add something, Benji?
I'll just say one thing, which is that we have a pretty good sense. Researchers have done a pretty good job of sort of forecasting stuff like this, like where specific diseases will move. And we don't have a very good sense of what's happening right now. It's a weird oversight where we're not clued into to the actual real-time implications of climate change and disease. But Grace and the AP are going to come out with a piece soon about that, so just stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Erin. I'm with the Texas Tribune. And I was going to... Actually, what you're saying is very much my question, because I've tried to look into some diseases in Texas, and what I've found is like some diseases are nationally notifiable, and then some are tracked differently state by state. And I'm just curious, like from a reporting perspective, like where would you all recommend like looking for the best like sources of data on the like current prevalence of some of these diseases in the areas that that we cover?
Benji, maybe I'll hand this to you right after. No, I'll take it. I have run into the same issue. Some states are really good at tracking data. Others are not. A lot of the red states don't have a lot of funding for their local health agencies, which is an issue. What I have found is that, academics at like the big universities will have done a pretty good job a lot of the time of doing that kind of work. Sometimes the data literally doesn't exist. And that's a real consideration. Like more articles need to be written about the fact that people are not tracking this. Like it's that is a huge blind spot in this country, and not just in this country. I mean, think about the global south. We've got many countries that have no system for surveillance at all.
Well, just real quick, one of the things that I think has been fascinating is the wastewater data, that we are able to look for now that we have whole genomic sequencing, and we can just take a sample of something and look at every DNA read in that, and then we match it to patterns because of the computing power we have. Picking up poliovirus in wastewater now, we're really tracking probably the best way of coronavirus is through wastewater. And really, that's completely open to whatever you want to look for if it is somehow makes it into wastewater. So through, runoff, through humans and that sort of thing. So that's a place to look for, but you have to want to look for it and you have to know what you're looking for. The rest of the diseases of interest, we do a pretty tight tracking of a lot of illnesses because of infection prevention in hospital. And hospitals and payers, back to the insurance, they really want to know as well. So they have some incredible data. You can get Medicare payer data on different diagnoses as well, which is open for searching. So you can look at Medicare data for whatever diagnosis that you have, or a surrogate marker for that for doxycycline or a treatment if you knew that was a specific treatment for something. So there are ways to get at changes, but then you have to factor them in for your population and population changes as well.
I was just going to say, even though I was like saying that there's not great surveillance, I will say there's this, obviously we're in this era of crowdsourcing information, and there's been a really tremendous increase in data just taken from people taking photos in the field. I know that's not necessarily disease occurrence, but at least occurrence of vectors. And so I think that is something that is a positive in the space.
I started, one of my projects that I'm working on is environmental and social map, and it has maybe 40 layers on it with over 50,000 plus data points in the map with all the layers included, and all of it is public source. And the problem with that is that every day I have to go on there and make sure one of my layers hasn't been deleted or the information hasn't been deleted, but that's through an ArcGIS account. And so if you can get access to that, you can just type in your keyword search query, and it will pull up all the agencies that publicly report that data. And so my job is to take that data and crunch it into like a digestible format for my community who can't read Excel sheet data.
Hi, my name's Kylie. Can you hear me okay?
Okay, great.
I guess my question is mostly for Benji. I know you report on wildlife a lot, and like you mentioned, COVID kind of got people's attention with wildlife and zoonotic disease spillover. Do you ever find it difficult to communicate about wildlife that isn't yet at that phase of spillover but still suffering from different diseases? So essentially, like, do you always need that human angle to tell the story in a compelling way?
I do find it really difficult. I think avian flu is a good example. There has not been that many stories about, Audubon has done a great story on this, but there have not been that many stories about just the impact of H5N1 on wild bird populations, which is really, really severe. I mean, I just saw that I think 18 California condors have been killed from avian flu, which is very sad given how much work has been put in to recover that population. And it's scary to think about what would happen if more of them get infected or the breeding center gets infected. So I do think that it's difficult. The panel that I had yesterday was about how do we do a better job at engaging audiences on issues of biodiversity when it seems like it's very hard to break through. People are numb to some of the common narratives about species in decline. And so I do think that it helps when we can talk about biodiversity loss as being a human concern. But I also think there are ways to communicate the risk to wildlife in its own right. You can talk about ecosystem services, for example, as being affected by large amounts of birds dying if they're not providing services like pest control and so forth. So there are other human ways into it, but it definitely helps to have that human element. But I also think one of the takeaways from yesterday was just telling these like compelling narratives and giving wildlife a voice in a way that it doesn't necessarily have in a lot of stories, like making wildlife seem like individuals with their own stories. I think that helps bring attention to issues if it's not necessarily directly impacting humans.
Hi, my name is Chloe Johnson. I work for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. I'm curious if anyone on the panel has thoughts about how farming needs to change. I'm thinking particularly about CAFOs, and in Minnesota we have a lot of turkey raising operations that have been hit very hard by this flu, but at the same time, I mean, they have like crazy biological controls in place in all of these facilities already, right? And it's still breaking through and then probably also affecting wildlife in turn. So what are your thoughts on farming?
I can start on that. I think one of the most important thing that needs to happen is that we need to start making avian vaccines mainstream in the U.S. I know that last week, the USDA said that it's trialing four different avian vaccines. And to me, that is absolutely essential. The issues that are holding back vaccines in the U.S., which are already licensed, just not approved, have to do with geopolitics, not with the science, not with our understanding of their effectiveness. It's just that countries are afraid to import from the U.S. or other countries that vaccinate because they have trouble distinguishing between a vaccinated animal with antibodies and one that's infected. And so there are ways around that. So I think vaccines need to become much more mainstream. I think there's also an animal welfare argument here. When you pack animals together, obviously that causes disease to spread. And then mink farming is problematic for a number of reasons, and I think that we have seen examples of outbreaks, and so I think we should be taking a critical look at the value add of those operations, given the risks.
Just the avian flu is, I mean, the vaccine for that is incubated in a chicken egg, and so, you know, there's been very little effort, unfortunately, to develop an mRNA vaccine for it. Which is kind of wild. I mean, we have this burgeoning problem, and there has not been aggressive or proactive action on it. So, I think that really ties into the ag conversation, right? Like, the solution is in the problem in a way. So,
it's tough because you add that with the increasing protein demands of the population, growth, and so. How do you meet that demand with where we are now? Because, you know, larger and larger factory farms like feeding the elk are aggregating species where they're not meant to be. And so you have to have tighter and tighter controls to not introduce something with extra vaccinations that are getting away from the natural way these species live. So, you know, one, it would be to be a more plant-based, you know, society. Number two, to have, you know, smaller areas of more local food growth so that we're not taking that exposure and that risk and transporting it across the United States. That in this general situation there would have to be a lot of major changes upstream before we could really get to that area, because we are, you know, using a lot of the farmland in Iowa to transport corn and soy outside of the United States, when we could be using it for smaller, you know, I'm way outside of my lane on that. But that's really where those upstream thin threads get to us with, you know, I've seen more salmonella in humans this year than I probably have for quite a while.
Anyone else?
Hey, it's my turn.
Yeah, so, you know, mention the valley fever, and valley fever is one of those, it takes both. It takes the water to enrich the soil with that fungus, and then it has to have dry conditions or human disturbance of that soil to then disseminate it out. So that's certainly one aspect, but I think the extreme still, when you have, you know, drought, then the soil is less able to hold the water, and then you have the rain, and you have the runoff from, you take runoffs from the, you know, farms that gets into the water, and you have the algae blooms. So, you know, it, the mosquitoes don't live in drought, but ticks, since they live several years, are not as affected by those droughts. So then you have the rodent populations that come and go at us. So mosquitoes are much more variable. They're more like weather. Ticks are more like climate, because they follow some of those bigger aspects. So, you know, temperature, runoff, the extremes get us away from how our landscape is meant to handle them.
There's also things like the bubonic plague and gophers that have lost all their natural predators, wolves and all of the predators on the prairie that used to be there can't be there anymore because of all the fences. And so we've got bubonic plague.
Hi, I'm Luis, freelancer from Houston. I just wanted to ask a further question about the international dimension of this. Some of y'all alluded to how there's not really great pandemic surveillance and disease surveillance. I was wondering if there's been any change at international bodies, like either in forums like COP or the WHO, thinking about zoonotic disease transmission, or is there, like, even at a regional scale, are y'all aware of, like, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico having more dialogue about this issue, or even within the U.S., in different states, less funding in public health, having to do that kind of cooperation?
Yeah, it's a lot of questions in that one question. But certainly, as we're talking about these, you know, emergent viruses, and part of your question got to that, you know, you want to set that up in those areas where you're going to have hotspots emerge. So places like Africa are going to be there. We have the poor livestock keepers. We have, you know, displaced people. We have, you know, climate impacts. Those are where the spillovers are going to happen. So setting up these whole genomic sequences for animals on the bubble, you know, the domestic animals that are close and in deforested ecosystems, you know, surveillance of those people on the bubble, the poor livestock keepers in those areas. You know, when we went back and looked at for origin of SARS, the classic SARS, SARS-1, we looked at butcher, you know, in the markets, the vegetable handlers as controls, livestock keepers, and we saw zero evidence that they had that. The hantavirus in the Four Corners, we were able to zero, you know, so there are those areas to set up that, those surveillance. And there are researchers setting up that surveillance. Public health has really been decimated in a lot of the United States. So we are down in that sort of surveillance aspect. I am encouraged, again, as I mentioned, the wastewater surveillance, you know, because we're able to do an awful lot in a single sampling area. But how that gets funding is hard to know as well. So
my tribes are separated by the U.S. and Canadian border, and we're trying to do a transboundary bison reintroduction project, not a farm bison, but a wild herd that would hopefully go through Glacier National Park and Waterton Park. And so the trouble that we're having right now is that any funding allocation in the U.S. is only meant to stay in the U.S. And so, and I keep saying, like, well, we send all of these grants for aid to other countries. Like, what about our reservations? Like, we need this money here. And we can't get, it's really hard because the meetings are like Blood Tribe, Blackfeet Tribe, the four Blackfoot Tribes, Montana State, Alberta Province, the U.S. federal government and the Canadian federal government, and that's a lot of people to put at the same table and then also say, this is what we're planning. And then they're saying, the first question is always, well, who's paying for it? And that no U.S. money can go to Canada and no Canadian money can come to the U.S. And so how do we work our communities that are separated by a border? We're trying to figure it out, and I think bison reintroduction would be the first transboundary international management method.
Let's do it. I just want the Secretary of the Interior.
Yeah.
No. Let's do. Do we? Everyone have patience through my questions? Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Cool. Let's do it.
It seems like it should make sense, but I have no data on it.
I don't have hard data. I have experience. I'm trying to do public education for CWD as it spreads. And even my project manager is like, well, why even do the project if you can't do anything about it? Well, we can't do anything about anything if we can't fix cancer if we don't know more of that. And so public education is key, and I would suggest that you all create titles that are not fear-based, but hopeful, as in there is a solution, or this could be possibly a solution. So try to steer away from fear-based, fear-mongering, and then put a little tidbit of hope in there, because that's what helps our kids, say, come up with the ideas that we have prevented ourselves from.
Do you mind if I ask another kind of working in journalism question? Okay, so my name's James. I'm a freelancer from Seattle. So my impression, having worked kind of on some of this, is that especially when it comes to public health for things that have not happened yet, so for instance, with CWD, a zoonosis into a human, which is a possibility but not ever been proven, I've found that can be a very hard story to get people interested in, even more so than climate change. Now, I think has much more of a people buy into it more when you talk about future risks. Now, do you think that approaching these possible health risks, should there be a different strategy, or is there a different strategy that you should use when trying to report this or trying to, as a freelancer, like, tell a story to somebody?
I run into the exact same problem. Like, if there is not something that we can show happening now, it's like wrestling with my editor to get him to let me do the story. And so I think that I just lean heavily into the data, any data that I have that show how much of a risk that it could be. We just did a story about Valley Fever and how it's linked to the Colorado River crisis. And that is an example of, we know that it's the belt that Valley Fever exists in is likely to spread under future droughts in the West. And I think that because the severity of the potential impact is so great. Like, that story just really leans into that and really leans into the data showing the potential expansion. But I don't have a great answer. It's just difficult.
Yeah, but I feel like, you know, tying it into another crisis is sort of the move. It's like, is this part of a larger trend? Usually it is. And then, you know, can you tie it to something that is related and that people are, you know, will click on? I have found, for whatever reason, that these kinds of stories have, like, immense success at Grist. And I'm not really sure why. I think it's the scare factor. But, and I am trying to, like, I don't want to, like, do scary stories in order to, like, get clicks. It's, like, not my goal. But for whatever reason, like, you know, I wrote about the Lone Star chick that makes you look to red meat. Like, that in of itself is, that's, like, a clickable headline. And that is literally just the disease that it gives you. So, I think that finding those curious, the element of surprise, the reason why I decided to cover climate change and health in the first place is because these stories kind of, they bowl me over every time. So I think that element of wonder and surprise really does get editors to sign on. And yeah.
I was just going to say, like, my tick story, I think, was like, the ticks are coming for you or something. Like, I'm sorry for leaning into fear, but it works when it works.
Yeah, and, like, that's kind of okay. Anyway, thank you all so much for coming. Thanks to our panelists.